My name is Gary Burge. I'm on the faculty at Calvin Seminary. I teach New Testament, and prior to that, I was in Chicago. I was on the faculty at Wheaton College for about 25 years, hard to believe, but there it is. It's funny how time goes by. And and I do New Testament here, and so we're now fully acclimated to Grand Rapids. I know all the secrets of Grand Rapids. It's really amazing. I know where 29th Street is. I know where Wealthy Street is. I know where Russo's is. How am I doing? Is that, anybody know? It's pretty good. Yeah, I know. I know Cascade is 100 miles away. So that's really interesting how it is. So anyway, here we are. Well, what we want to do in this workshop is I want to talk about parables. One of my areas of interest is in historical Jesus studies and in the Gospels, the Gospel of John, I work in a lot. But parables certainly is one area that I have really, really enjoyed. One of the things I've noticed inside of church is if you say in church, hey, we're going to have a series, we're going to launch on the parables of Jesus, do you know that everybody gets really happy about that? It's really interesting. They love these stories. Something resonates with us in them. So therefore, I made a handout here, which you have. Can I borrow this for a moment? Sure. So therefore you have this handout, and if you are so inspired at the end of this workshop that you say to yourself, our church is going to do a series on the parables of Jesus, I've given you a 15 sermon series. There it is right there. And, so you can work that out, and, there are quite a few parables, but I thought, well, wouldn't it be nice to have a selection of 15 that would be organized in a way that would work inside of church? The other thing is, on the second half of this page, I show you how I think about my own preparation when I'm working with a new text, a new parable of some kind. And everybody knows, of course, that you master the text, you use commentaries, that kind of thing. But most people don't realize that there are specialized studies that recreate the cultural, historical background to these parables. And I've given you a list of those people who have tried to do that. And what I've discovered over time is that most people don't even know about these books. They know about commentaries, but they've never really found these. So if you have a volume that really is written by someone who does cultural anthropology, but also New Testament studies, New Testament theology, and weds those two, today we have sort of a wedded discipline in these two, then you're going to really benefit from that. You'll be surprised. You really will be surprised. Okay, so what I would like to do is just introduce the whole notion of parables and how they worked in Jesus' own ministry and give you some idea of the significance of the parables. It seems most scholars are going to tell you that this was Jesus' preferred means of teaching. One third of everything that Jesus taught was in the form of parables. So therefore, what he liked to do, what this means is that he liked to tell stories. So therefore, he would just, if somebody asked him a question, he would generate a story about, say, a woman who has 10 coins, one gets lost, and of course she searches everywhere to find the one, and she celebrates when she gets it. So this is something that is characteristic inside of the Middle East, telling a story in order to make your point. Jesus liked to use colorful illustrations. Rather than talk about, say, the bankruptcy of his Pharisee opponents in a debate, he just simply says, "You guys remind me of whitewashed tombs." What? You know, instead of saying, there's a bankruptcy here at the very heart. Where did you go to seminary? Western? Anyway, that was a joke. It's our competitive seminary over in Holland. Anyway, so what? He doesn't do that abstraction thing in a debate. Instead, he tells a story. And if you know something about a whitewashed tomb, if you've ever been around a sarcophagus, say in the Middle East, made out of limestone, it gets bleached in the sun, they're beautiful. You have decoration all around the outside, but inside it's full of bones. Anyway, outside beautiful, inside awful. So Jesus does this kind of thing all the time. When scholars who debate the authenticity of the sayings of Jesus, an extremist like Bart Ehrman on the one hand, you know, and a conservative on the other like Craig Keener, when they debate about where do we really hear the authentic voice of Jesus, this is where they go every time. They say the parables of Jesus are the bedrock of authenticity. They have a personal character. They have a unique clarity. There is a simplicity. There is a mastery of construction in all of these, all right? So that means the parables of Jesus, they are significant. They are significant when you're trying to give Jesus a profile. We don't have really any parallels in first century Judaism that precede the life of Jesus. We have over 2,000 similar kinds of storytelling things that happened among rabbis teaching in the period after Jesus, but Jesus really seems to be different than the rest of his peer group in this sense, okay? All right, so the parables are significant, all right? Second thing is, we could probe also why Jesus liked to teach this way. First thing is, telling a story is a great way to disarm your enemies. So if you have opponents who are in front of you, it's really a nice thing to just say, okay, let me tell you guys a story. And then they're left wondering, did he just tell that story about us or what? So that's one thing that you can do with this. The symbols can be taken various ways, and therefore your opponents may not know exactly what you've said. Second thing is this, it is a way to connect with your audience. Jesus would use local color, and as every good storyteller knows, when you use local color and local metaphors and everything, your audience really likes that kind of thing. It happens to me in class all the time. In fact, it happens in any audience that I have. If I say to the audience, I have a story I have to tell you, listen to this. Do you know that all of you change physically? Can you not? You know what you do? Yes, right. This is okay, right here. Right. Greg, is it? I can't quite see. Yeah. Right. Slouchy. Pen goes down. Smile on his face. It's time for a movie. Yeah, exactly. It's entertainment. It's going to be good. Let's listen to this. That's really funny. Once I coach my classes into this, they all get slouchy at the right times. It's wonderful. So when it comes to telling a parable, everyone likes this. It connects with us. We relax. We're stunned a little bit. Actually, when you do a sermon, that can be the bane of your entire preaching experience. Have you had this experience? You preach, you work really hard in this amazingly articulate, theologically sophisticated, complex, amazing sermon, something Chrysostom would wish he could have done. Anyway, you lay out this whole sermon, and then in the very middle of the sermon, you tell a dumb story about one time when you're in the kitchen with your dog. And then you have this great sermon. And on the way out the door, you're standing there talking to people and people say to you, I have a dog and I really love that dog too. The sermon wasn't about the dog. It was about, well, you know. Anyway, there is a risk with all of this. But the other thing is that sermons are parables, storytelling like this, that's memorable. That's the other thing. It's memorable. People do remember what you say when you put it in the form of a story. Have you not had that happen in your life? You really work hard to craft an excellent story, and there you have it, okay? The other thing is that we tend to have a cultural bias when it comes to the parables of Jesus. We tend to think, well, if somebody is a storyteller and they cannot sort of carry on like a theologian from Notre Dame, then maybe they lack sophistication. There's a kind of cultural hubris that goes on with us. Jesus lived in a world that was utterly different than ours, but it was a world that was no less sophisticated. The thing is that we are in a culture of abstract thinkers. We are heirs to the Greek tradition, and so therefore we think that if you can string out a series of arguments long enough, and they are persuasive enough, and you can pound down your audience, then they're going to be persuaded, right or wrong. Just listen to CNN sometime, or worse yet, Fox or MSNBC. It's like, really? Can they keep talking so long? We don't tend to be a storytelling culture. We don't. I spend quite a bit of my time in the Arabic Middle East, and when you are in those cultures, they are filled with stories. So therefore you ask, so how should a son behave when guests come to the house? And inevitably, the parents will say, well, let me tell you a story. That is a reflex which is inside of the culture. We are not filled with stories. We like stories, but we get them elsewhere. We get them from television. We get them from movies. Everybody likes stories, but we don't generate them ourselves. So we think that if you can write a book about something, if you can string out arguments to defend yourselves, it is going to work. We are the masters of droning prose. It just goes on and on and on, all right? So Jesus, however, is living inside of a culture where not only do you tell stories, you have to tell these stories with a degree of sophistication. So therefore, Jesus has to deliver a story effectively. You have to inside of this world. So Jesus lived in a world, I would say, that was filled with drama. The problem is when we read the Gospels, we tend to flatline them. There is no emotional dimension to what you read inside of the Gospels. When you hear a parable, you think, Jesus just sounds like a professor somewhere. And he just speaks in a monotone. Are you kidding me? This is a dramatic culture. It is a culture where speakers have to be entertaining. Jesus was theatrical. We don't think of it that way, do we? He had to be theatrical. No speeches about a corrupt temple. He ransacks the temple. Nice. Okay. Next time I'm sort of feeling grumpy about something here at the seminary, I know what to do. I'll just knock over some furniture. Nice. No lectures about the doom of Jerusalem. Instead, he walks up to a fig tree and says, you know, I know it's not the season for figs. It's springtime, but you're dead. What? He kills fig trees. No horticulturist there. No sermon about the cost of discipleship. Instead, he says, you know, if you really want to follow me, you should pick up a cross and carry it. Now, you and I are so acclimated to that one, we don't even think about it. We think crosses, yeah, everybody has a cross, a little sterling silver thing. Are you kidding? He's talking about an instrument of execution. What a shocker. You are going to say to your followers, you have to carry some kind of a symbol of execution? That just doesn't make sense. So therefore, what you have inside of the teachings, the stories of Jesus, is clever sayings. Jesus was clever. The Middle East delights in the crisp story. Here's a great proverb that comes from this culture. A good teacher never serves his students a basket of cucumbers, but always places a peppercorn under the tongue. One of the things they have in the Middle East is they grow small cucumbers. You know, in our grocery stores, they're really big and they're fat and they're long. Ugh, they don't like those. Anyway, they're small. They're short. They're about this big. And they sell them in all the markets. And you go through and you pick them up and you eat them just like you would eat fruit or something. Anyway, so can you imagine if you went into a class? All of my students have had this kind of class. And this professor came in and said, here is what I'm serving today. A basket of cucumbers. Have you ever eaten more than one cucumber? It is so disgusting. Anyway, your stomach's full. You've got horrible breath. It's just like, oh, are you kidding me? No. A good teacher never serves a basket of cucumbers. Instead, what a good teacher does is places a peppercorn under the tongue so it burns you. That's the idea. So that you walk away scalded. That's the idea. So the rabbis understood that if you're going to be successful in any of your communication, this is the thing that you have got to do, and do it successfully. Here, let me tell you a story, and you will have an idea of how this works in the Middle East. Thank you. So assume the position. In the Middle East, from 1975 to 2000, there was a dreadful civil war in Lebanon. Terrible civil war. I was a student at the American University of Beirut. At the beginning of that war, it was just horrible. It was really militias running throughout the city, Muslim militias killing Christian militias. It was the worst thing ever. For 25 years, the Paris of the Middle East was destroyed in front of everyone. There were casinos, huge hotels. Beirut was the place you went to play. That's how the Middle East looked at Beirut, and it was gone in 25 years. Well, about three quarters of the way through the civil war, there was a convening of leaders, national leaders and militia leaders in the largest auditorium of Beirut. And they were all asking the question on live television. The entire country virtually was watching this. Who do we blame for the civil war in which we have destroyed our country? Who do we blame? Well, one political leader got up, another political leader got up, and then a Maronite priest who was kind of like the patriarch for the country, it was an amazing guy. I mean, he looked like he was right out of the Old Testament, beard, staff, the whole thing. Anyway, Elijah walks up and they say, Father, Abuna, what is it? What happened to us? So he comes up to the microphone, the country is watching, and he says, let me tell you a story. Now, what I'm about to recite to you has been recited in the midst, this story I'm telling you, has been heard in Baghdad, Iraq, and in Libya. This moment is so famous in the Arab Middle East that people repeat it again and again. So, the priest said, once upon a time, there was a man named Ahmed. Now, that That is a very famous Arabic name. He was traveling through the desert with his camel. Now, Ahmed was a very good man. He loved his camel, and his camel loved him. He camped for the night in the desert. Every Arab understands, even if you've never been in the desert, you love the desert. You've never been to the desert, of course. Ahmed camped in the desert, and in the middle of the night, he heard a voice. It was the voice of his camel. And the voice said, "Ahmed, Ahmed, the night is cold and the wind is strong. Can I sleep with my nose under the flap of your tent?" Now, Ahmed was a very good man. He loved his camel, and his camel loved him. So he said, "Ahlan usahlan, my friend, please sleep with your nose under the flap of my tent." And they slept, and they slept well. And then, 2 hours later, Ahmed was awakened again, and Ahmed heard the voice of his camel. "Ahmed, Ahmed, the night is cold and the wind is strong. Can I sleep with my ears beneath the flap of your tent?" Now, Ahmed was a very good man. He loved his camel, and his camel loved him. Therefore, he said, "Ahlan usahlan, my friend, please sleep with your ears under the flap of my tent." And they both slept well. 2 hours later, Ahmed was awakened again. "Ahmed, Ahmed, the night is cold and the wind is, please may I sleep with my shoulders under the flap of your tent." Now, Ahmed was a very good man. He loved his camel and his camel loved him. So he said, "Ahlan usahlan, my friend, please sleep with your shoulders under the flap of my tent." And an hour later, suddenly, there was the crash of lightning. The camel jumped to his feet. The poles of the tent went flying and nearly killed Ahmed. And the priest sat down. The entire country gave him a round of applause. And they said, "Yes, that's it." "What? What's it? How does that solve anything?" Now, as I told you that story, and that story's been repeated all over the Middle East. I heard it from somebody who heard it in Baghdad. You should have intuited, first, that there was structure to the story, yes or no? Secondly, was it employing culture, forms, idioms, symbols, metaphors that were embedded in the recipient culture? Absolutely. It's not my culture. I shouldn't be able to understand these things. I coached you at the beginning just a bit. All right? Is it something that you could repeat tomorrow? Very possibly. You'll miss a few things, but you'll probably be able to repeat the thing tomorrow. And does it have a surprise? Did you have a sense that if the story was unfolding, you were moving in a direction, you're going to think to yourself, this can't go on forever? How many of you had that feeling? You know, come on. What are you going to get? The camel in there sleeping in a sleeping bag with Ahmed? No. There's a shock. There's a trap coming. There's a surprise in the box. There's something unexpected inside of that story. You know it's coming. The lightning flashes. Oh my gosh, Ahmed and his camel are almost dead when it's over. So what is a parable then? A parable is a trap. It is a figurative story with a surprise in it. It is a box that is so fun and interesting, when you begin to open it, suddenly, boom, out of the box comes a spring. It lures you into its story, and then it closes on you. It's a bit like this. He told them a parable saying, "Lord, the land of a rich man brought forth plentifully. And so therefore he thought to himself, what shall I do? I've got nowhere to store my crops." Instead of a strong tradition of Judaism in the first century, there was their version of prosperity gospel. And so therefore, this is a man everyone is assuming is being blessed by God. Oh, I can give you verses from Proverbs that'll affirm that. So he said, "I know I'm going to do this. I'm going to pull down my barns. I'm going to build larger ones. And then I'm going to store all of my grain and my goods. And then I'm going to say to my soul, soul, you have ample goods laid up for many years. Take your ease, eat, drink, sit on the porch, have an iced tea." But God said to him, "Fool, this night you are a dead man. And the things that you prepared in your estate, who's going to get them?" so is he who lays up treasure for himself and is not rich toward God. So therefore, you're listening to this story, you're drawn into this thing, and suddenly you discover there is something shocking that's inside of it. All right, so therefore, when we are looking, we're working with these stories, what are some things that we want to keep in mind? Here's the first. The first is the parables are not always allegories. That's the first idea. For those in the West who have actually, we are heirs to a Greek storytelling tradition in which allegory was one of the things we like. And therefore, that's not how you run a story inside of the Middle East. You're not supposed to assign meaning to every little bit inside of the story, not at all. The second thing we know is that there is this, what we call crisis and response. Crisis and response. In other words, you come through the story in shock. How did that happen? Where did that come from? And I am asked to respond to it in some way. Third thing is, the parables are always deeply embedded in the cultural framework of the first century. And in fact, I would narrow that even more. It is not urban Jerusalem. It is rural village life, basically in mountain Galilee. And that is important for us. We just can't generalize about, well, no one would ever say, what did Jews think in the first century? No. We're talking about Jews who are living in Judea and Galilee in mountain villages. That's Jesus' original context. So I've got to be able to decode this, and it's going to be the hardest thing of all. So therefore, when I am hearing a parable, when I'm beginning to see how parables work, there is actually a movement that a person experiences when they move through a parable. Here, let me illustrate it for you like this. There are three stages that I should experience if I'm listening rightly to a parable. First, I begin to hear a story, and I begin to be entertained by the story. I'm pulled in by the story. The elements of the story are only there to set you up so that you begin to say, yeah, I get it. I understand what's happening in the story. I like what's there. And then at the very center, somewhere inside of the story, there is the spring in the box, the shock, the trap springs. And therefore you, oh wow, I didn't see that one coming. I'm really surprised. So therefore, when I am shocked, then I am invited to begin reflecting theologically on what that trap was. In other words, I am not in the business of working out here, decoding and assigning meaning to all of the elements inside of the story. If you do that, you can get the parables to teach virtually anything. And that's what some people do when they present the parables. They say, well, I'm going to assign meaning in here. If you look at the history of the parable of the Good Samaritan in its interpretation, it's crazy what we've gotten out of that. It's incredible. So therefore, the whole point is, okay, here's the slap across the face. Here's the slap across the face. And therefore, I have to ask, how then do I think differently about who I am? Now, let's take this little short parable I just gave to you a moment ago. So therefore, I hear a story about a man who's got a 5-car garage. He's a guy who's got everything you would want. And I guess since he's religious, it must mean that God blesses him. And then the next thing I learn is that, oh, he's dead. Didn't get to use that new boat. He's dead. So who's going to get all of his wealth? That's really tragic. So I am invited then to reflect. So how are you valuing the things that you have been collecting and accumulating in this life? Has that been the end goal of what you've been living for? Is it accumulation? Is that what it is? There's the sermon. So the sermon, therefore, has to be anchored. It's tethered right here. It is not tethered out here. That is an enormously important idea. Okay. So all along, so what I've been suggesting then is that if you are telling a story in the first century, it is necessary for you to employ a technique, a strategy, a style. Most of us do not think about Jesus as having a style. Everybody has a style of teaching inside of their own culture. That's a given. It's true for us in our culture. Even how I'm setting this thing up using a screen, that's really a Western 21st century kind of thing, isn't it? So likewise, Jesus has got a style. There is a style. And that's what we want to look at. So look at here. If you don't think about some of the stylistic techniques of the first century, you're going to misuse a verse like this. One of my favorite verses. If your hand causes you to stumble, cut it off. It is better to go and enter life maimed than with two hands and go into hell. If your foot causes you to stumble, cut it off. It is better for you to enter life crippled than to have 2 feet and be thrown into hell. If your eye causes you, what in the world? I hope we don't take this one literally. What do I do with this? How do I understand this? All right. So I have to have some notion of how style is working inside of this culture. Okay. And let's work with this just for a moment or two. All right. So therefore, if I'm going to understand that kind of verse, I have got to keep in mind that this culture likes to do certain things when people talk. And if you sort of begin to listen to the teachings of Jesus as a first century listener, you're going to suddenly see that Jesus has got, he's got things that he's using that might be foreign to us. Here's the first one. Hyperbole or gross exaggeration or overstatement. Everybody in this culture liked that kind of thing. We do it once in a while. I am so hungry, I could eat a horse. I do not want to eat a horse, thank you very much. But that's what I say. Luke 14:26, you have to hate your mother and father if you're going to be my disciple? That is gross exaggeration. It's hyperbole. So therefore, I look at this and I have to say, okay, this is the way you overstate your case in order to make your point. Jesus says in Matthew 23:23, woe to those who strain out a gnat and swallow a camel. That is a really nice example of this entire thing. Strain out a gnat and swallow a camel. I don't know how you could ever swallow a camel. I think you have to put them through a blender first. Anyway, but strain out a gnat. It's clever because gamla is camel in Aramaic and galma is gnat in Aramaic. It's a pun. Probably the listener said, this guy is so clever. Matthew 7:3. You find a speck in your brother or sister's eye, but you've got a log in your own. How does that work? That's gross exaggeration. In Matthew 10:24, it is easier for a rich man to go through the eye of a needle than for a camel to go through an eye of a needle than for a rich person to enter the kingdom of heaven. You've seen that one before, haven't you? Right? And again, this is one of the things that's hard when you're taking guests to the Middle East. You've heard this explanation, and maybe you've preached it. I'm about to ruin something for you. Anyway, there are these large gates, and therefore, if you want to get into the gate, there's a small gate inside of the large gate. How many of you ever heard this one before? And you go through a camel's got to take off all of his gear in order to get through the little gate, and of course, that's his sin. Get rid of your sin. You can go through the small gate. You make it into heaven. Okay, that's nice. Problem is, all those small gates are medieval. They didn't exist in Jesus' day. This is a crazy hyperbole. That's what it is. So can you get a camel through the eye of a needle? That little gate's not the eye of the needle at all. That's what tour guides say. And they're going to get a tip from you. So they'll tell you anything. Sometimes when I have a group that I'm leading over in the middle in Jerusalem, my group is off shopping or something, and I see a tour guide coming through, it's just so fun. I just lean against the wall, and I just love to listen to tour guides. It's just like, really? Are you kidding me? There's this piece of me wants to raise my hand, and I say, wait. There wasn't anything like that. Wait, whatever. Okay, so hyperbole is important. If you don't use hyperbole, you're going to miss a pun. People loved puns like this. I just gave you Galma and Gamla from Matthew 23. But when Jesus says, Peter, yeah, you are a rock, and on this rock I'll build my church. And you guys know I trust that in Greek, Petros, Petra, this is rock. Aramaic, Kepha, that is rock in Aramaic. So that's why it's called Cephas. So therefore, this is a kind of feature. It's cleverness. It's fun when you have these. Using metaphors and similes, that's likewise a part of what people would do in this world, and Jesus did the same. Matthew 10, be wise as serpents, innocent as... Yeah, exactly. And you remember it because it's clever. Faith is like a grain of mustard seed, which happens to be the smallest seed in the whole... I really was with someone once in the Middle East in Israel, and they were in a crisis because there's a place you can go and get mustard seed, and they held mustard seed in their hand. They go, I've seen smaller seed than this. Was Jesus wrong? It's like crisis. Anyway, the idea is that let Jesus use the kind of exaggerated overstatement that his culture demands of him. All right, so similes and metaphors, all of those are a part of this. You are the salt of the earth. You are the light of the world. You know how that goes. All right. The other thing is that using proverbs, memorable proverbs, were also commonplace in all of Jesus' world. This is how you express memorable wisdom. So where your treasure is, so will your heart be also. Nice. Matthew 6:21. A prophet is not without honor except in his own country. Nice. Mark 6, verse 4. Okay, I got it. All right, so therefore, proverbial sayings likewise. The other thing we know is that paradox was also really common. So you would say things to your audience that set them back on their heels and that didn't make any sense. So therefore, Jesus in Mark 12 is in the temple in the treasury area, and a woman comes in and puts in like one penny. And Jesus says, "Hold it! This woman just put in more money than anybody else." And you're standing there thinking, "Are you kidding me? Didn't you see the guy with a bag of denariuses? This woman didn't do that." And Jesus says, "Well, of course she did. The first will be last, and the last are going to be first. If you want to gain your life, you've got to lose your life. And then when you lose your life, you're going to gain your life." What? So I'm going to gain my life after I die? How's this going to go down? It doesn't make a lot of sense. Then there's also figurative acts. This was really common, and this is the one that is probably pretty foreign to us. In other words, to reinforce your teachings, what you want to do, just like the Old Testament prophets did, is you wanted to do something that was memorable that we probably would deem eccentric. Yes, we don't like this kind of thing. So therefore, when Jesus steps in Luke 19 into a village in Jericho, he sees Zacchaeus in a tree and he says, "Zacchaeus, I'm going to have dinner with you tonight." Now, I'll guarantee you that the elders of the synagogue of Jericho already had their wives cooking all day to welcome this famous teacher. And Jesus has just backed out of that and said, "I'm going to be with that guy." What? You can't be serious. He works for the IRS. So likewise, when Jesus is baptized, very same thing. You have this dramatic scene, and we take away from that scene its meaning. Jesus walks up to a fig tree, like we said earlier, and he curses it. All of these things are supposed to, the more dramatic they are, the more eccentric they seem, the better they are. Actually, I saw an example of this a couple of Januaries, 5 or 6 Januaries ago. It was the Right to Life March in Washington, D.C. And this woman just did the most incredibly brilliant but shocking thing. What she did is somewhere she got a hold of a late first trimester fetus. She put it in formaldehyde in a jar, and then she hung it from a rope and put it on a stick with a sign saying, "This is what we're protecting." Now, she got in all kinds of trouble for this. The media were there, and she said simply, "If this is not a person, it shouldn't matter." It was great. I thought, oh, that is so like Jesus. So there she was holding a fetus up there on his, and everyone is shocked. She made it into the press. She had to explain why she was doing this. Oh, she got into trouble, but she loved every minute of it. That's the kind of shocking, eccentric thing that we should expect when we look inside of the Gospels. So therefore, when we talk about parables, we're really talking about this kind of thing. We're talking about parables that are a unique style that someone living in Jesus' culture certainly would have looked for. Now, the hardest thing for you and for me when we work with parables is unlocking the culture. That's going to be the difficulty every single time. Because if it's true that these stories are foreign to us, if it's true that they are not native to, we're not going to get them. Like the Lebanese story about Ahmed and his camel. You're like, what is happening here? We are going to misrepresent the parables. That's the catch. Now, the person that I think is probably our most helpful, interpreter of the parables today is this guy here. His name is Kenneth Bailey. How many of you have heard of Kenneth Bailey? Yeah, Ken Bailey, he grew up in Egypt. His first language was Arabic because he spells horribly in English. Anyway, Ken grew up in Egypt. His parents were part of that Presbyterian missions legacy that goes all the way back in Egypt to the 1840s. It is the success story of Presbyterian missions, that and South Korea. It's a great story for Egypt. They were not a part of the colonial enterprise, and they indigenized the church immediately. Within 15 years, they had an Arabic-speaking seminary in Cairo. It's a cool story, the Egyptian Presbyterian story. Today, there are 350,000 Presbyterians in Egypt. Who knew? So anyway, Ken grows up there, and as a child, actually, he lived through the World War II, and you know, Rommel was trying to take Egypt across North Africa. It's a really amazing story about this man's life. So this is a part of his own experience. He has a PhD in New Testament studies, and one of the key things I think that Ken gave to all of us was a consciousness that we are foreigners to the culture of the parables. Now, how do I get into all of this? How do I break into ancient culture? Well, there are a number of things Ken would always want to remind us of. The first is, okay, don't treat these things like allegories. Please never again assign meanings to all of the elements there. Second thing he says is many times what people try to do is they try to indigenize the parables. Now, let me explain to you what he means by this. Some people want to assume that the first century peasant thinks like we think. So therefore, we say to ourselves, well, how would someone in Jesus' day feel if someone knocked on the door and said, please, I need bread? How would he feel in the first century? I know how he would feel. He'd feel like I would feel. Wouldn't like it a bit. Ken says, well, no, hold on. No. You can't do that. You can't simply take your own cultural values and indigenize them into the first century. No, you can't do that. It just doesn't work because cultures are different. And besides, Ken would say, and heard him say this, he said, the guy would have never knocked. Strangers knock at night. Friends call from the window. So, indigenization, that's one thing people do. The other is to say, well, we should universalize these things. All cultures have the same elements inside of them. All of humanity has the same reflexes. So, therefore, we can predict what people should be thinking. So, when a son comes up to you and says, I want my inheritance, and you haven't died yet. Well, you can go anywhere around the world and you will have a universal reaction of offense. Ken says, you can't do that. Because when you travel around the world, things are just so different. There's a whole community of New Testament scholars who just simply despair. And they say, you can't do it. Rudolf Bultmann, you heard of Rudolf Bultmann? Most famous, probably one of the most brilliant New Testament scholars in the 20th century. Unfortunately, he didn't believe in much of anything. Bultmann, that was his take on the parables. You can't understand them. You have lost the culture. The gap is too wide, and so it's wrong. So Ken says, no. Bailey says, you can't do that. Bailey says, you can enter the ancient world. You can go back there. But it's hard to do. You just need some guidance. First of all, what you could do is read ancient literature. In other words, it isn't just that the New Testament was living in the first century. The New Testament was there, sure. But Jews were writing all kinds of literature. And if you can read all of that other literature, you would get some idea of what the cultural reflexes are like. But sometimes it is like looking for a raw diamond in a gravel pit. If you really don't know what a raw diamond looks like, you'll never find it. So you have to be an astute observer of this literature. Second thing Ken says is you can look at ancient translations. So for instance, you have got texts which began in Aramaic or Hebrew, and they were early on translated into Armenian or Greek or early Latin or even early Arabic. And when a translator who is bilingual has got to take the message of this text and move it to another language, which we may know well, like Latin, he has got to make some judgments so that the receiving culture over here will understand what the original text meant, and he'll make changes. Okay, Ken says, that's another way that we can go about this. We can read ancient translations. The third thing, Ken says, is that we can be cultural anthropologists. In other words, what we need to be able to do is go into the world of the current Middle East, which is rapidly disappearing. A Middle East which was known well by another generation, even before 1950, what has changed the culture and universalized so many things and brought Western culture to the Middle East is the internet on the television. I have been in small villages in southern Iraq where they barely have electricity, but there's a satellite dish on somebody's house. And you're thinking, what is going on there? And they're watching from satellite old American reruns. You're like, sad. How sad is that? So how do I get into Middle Eastern culture? How do I understand a peasant's life? Well, here's some of the things that Paley would do. Now, there's attempts at this. The first one he calls the view from the saddle, or I call it the view from the bus. One of the problems here is that there have always been people who've traveled to the Middle East, and they come home and they say, I just came on my first tour of Israel, and I can explain everything to you now. Have you ever come across that before? Oh my gosh, it is so horrible. 19th century missionaries have written books like this. They went on their first big 4-week tour of the Middle East. They come back and write a book and they make a fortune and they say, I will tell you what the culture of the first century was like. Ken calls that the view from the saddle, the view from the bus window. A 2-week trip looking out a bus window will never show you what's happening inside of this culture. Second thing is, there are some people who have what he calls a view from a study window. There are scholars who lived in the Middle East, and they recorded and they graphed everything that they saw, but they were still outsiders. There are, for example, many scholars who actually were children growing up in Jerusalem and Cairo. They spoke English or French. They never were fully integrated into their world, and yet they were, as it were, outsiders interpreting what they saw. And the interpretation was never very sophisticated. If you have ever come across the book by Alfred Edersheim, you can almost get it for free today, The Life and Times of Jesus the Messiah, about 1,000 pages. Has anyone heard of Edersheim? The most dangerous book. Because Edersheim is just giving you these grand generalizations about how people lived in the first century without any understanding that people change century to century. The third way people have tried to do this was what Ken calls a view from the single village. In other words, there are some Middle Easterners who live inside of their own village and they come out of that village and they come to the West and they say, I'm going to write a book for you about how the Middle East understands the parables of Jesus. You'll find those books as well. And because they have a Jewish or Arabic name, you think this must be it. Have you heard of Lamza Gospel Light? Thank the Lord you haven't heard of that. Okay, never mind. Don't write that down. Ken, instead, says what you need to do is have what he calls the view from the mastaba. The mastaba is the stone or mud brick bench which is in front of virtually every peasant Arab's home from Iraq to Libya. This is where the men, principally, sit late in the day and they tell stories. This is the place where culture is passed from one generation to the next. And Ken says, if you speak the language, if you are invited onto the mastaba, because you have been accepted as an insider, you will then begin to hear things that the tourist is never able to hear. This has been the effort that Ken has given, and I'm going to put a couple of books up here just because I know that you'll think about resources eventually. This is probably the most famous book that Ken has done. Virtually every pastor who preaches from Luke 15, the parable of the prodigal son, has been influenced by this book right here, The Cross and the Prodigal. This is an older version. This is my copy, but you can see it's actually the original. It was printed like an Arabic book. This is a Western version with InterVarsity Press. This is a collection of two books. Erdman's now publishes two books together. These are Ken's interpretations of the parables of Jesus, and it is a gold mine. It really is. It's on your bibliography. All right. He, toward the end of his life, produced two massive volumes. The first was Jesus Through Middle Eastern Eyes, and then Paul Through Mediterranean Eyes. And here what he is doing is explaining to us how the culture was operating in some of the most important texts in the Gospels and over in 1 Corinthians. Okay? These are all significant books for him. He has a technical volume on Luke 15, The Prodigal Son. The other Prodigal Son books were made for lay people. This is Ken's technical work showing the basis of his interpretation. He has a whole study on how shepherding works in this culture and how it moves from Psalm 23 all the way to John chapter 10, where Jesus says he is the good shepherd. It's an amazing study, the thread of shepherding inside of biblical witness. And then Jacob and the Prodigal Son. He thinks that the Prodigal Son, the story, the ideas in the Prodigal Son actually come from the Jacob stories of the Old Testament. It's very fascinating. That last one on the right is probably his most interesting treatment. Okay, so what have we seen so far? We've said, okay, so there's some strategies you have to have when you interpret the Gospels. We get that. There are some resources that we could put to use because we need to break into the culture of the Middle East. I cannot simply read an English parable and say, I get it. I have got to humble myself before my ignorance. I have to confess that I am a foreigner to the story. The last thing that I want to show you is that if you are an excellent speaker, this is a culture of orality. This is a verbal culture. This is not people writing things down. You have to give structure to what you teach. You have to give structure. Okay? So, therefore, there are forms that you use, and the skilled ear is going to hear the forms. When I did Ahmed and the Camel, that's why I asked you, did you hear the structure as I was telling it? You heard the structure. You felt the structure. How many times did I repeat the cycle of Ahmed asking? 3 times. See, you guys have all got that. It's not 2, it's not 4. So, therefore, what we know is that we have these. Now, here's an example of a very, very simple. It's all built on parallelism. They love parallelism. Have you ever read the Psalms, you know, where David says something like, praise God from the heights, praise God from the mountaintop? You're like, come on, David, get an editor. Anyway, repeating things are just like essential for this. Alas, for those who are with child and for those who nurse in those days. Same thing. For great distress shall be upon the earth, wrath upon these people. Same thing. They will fall by the edge of the sword and be led captive among the nations. Same thing. So this is a very simple parallelism. This is kindergarten here. This is very simple. And we see how we mark it A prime, B, B prime, C, C prime. Okay? That's how we codify it for ourselves today. Here's another one, which is called a step parallelism. It's really nice. You know this one. Ask and it shall be given. Seek, you shall find. Knock, it will be opened. Everyone who asks receives. Seeks, knocks. Do you see how that goes? So it actually just climbs. It's easy to memorize because if you drop a line, you'll know right away. Blessed are you poor, for yours is the kingdom of God. Blessed are those who are hungry, you shall be satisfied. Blessed are those who weep now, you shall laugh. Blessed are those when they hate you. Okay, I get all of that. Now I flip it around. But woe to you who are rich, full, laugh, and speak well, when people speak well of you. See how it's going? So in other words, you're doing an inverse of what you had in the first step parallelism. So you have a sort of a rhetorical sophistication in this culture. And if you are an artist, you will speak like this. People know when you are moving into your artistic form of expression. It isn't just sort of a pouring out of prose. No, you construct these things very carefully. The other one is what's called an inverted parallelism. I'm going to show it to you from Isaiah because I think Isaiah gives you such a nice example. Here, take a look at this. Now, we're talking here, this is hundreds of years before Jesus. Arise and shine because your light has come and the glory of Yahweh upon you has arisen. For behold, darkness shall cover the earth, thick darkness the people. Okay, there's the parallel. And upon you shall arise, yes, I see it, Yahweh, there it is, key word, his glory upon you shall be seen, yes, there it is, they shall come, the Gentiles are going to come to your light, yes, okay, and kings will come to the brightness, yes, that's what it means to shine, of your rising, nice. Isn't that cool? That's very carefully crafted, that's from Isaiah, and the prophets have many of these. Most of us simply don't even know they're there, and our Bibles do not print them so that you can see this. We print in paragraphs, and therefore they're disguised to us. Okay? There's another form that was well known. It's called a chiasmus. That's a chi, a key in Greek. So therefore is Sabbath was made for man, not man for the Sabbath. And therefore you can see, you can just cross those by coming across. And so that's a clever thing. These are clever. That's the idea. You want to be clever. You combine forms if you're sophisticated. And I don't have time, I don't think, to just go ahead. This is the opening of Luke chapter 4, where Jesus gives his first inaugural sermon. Incredibly sophisticated. And I'll tantalize you by saying, go read it in Bailey. It is so interesting to see how this whole thing, you've got two stanzas, you've got an inversion at the top, and then you have a beautiful inversion right here that moves all the way to 8. It's really, really sophisticated. Okay, so anyway, what we've established then is that we have got inside of the Gospels, these sophisticated parables. Now, what I'd like to do is to illustrate this whole thing with one very tough parable. It's a parable, I think, that has received, I don't know, mistreatment maybe in more sermons than we can count. Because people just don't know what's actually going on inside of the parable. That's what I want to explore with you now. All right, so let's summarize. So I'm going to use cultural contextual clues inside of the story. I'm going to look for rhetorical or literary structures, and I want to know where the slap is. I want to know where the spring in the box is. That's what I'm looking for inside of this parable. Okay? All right, so what do I have? I have in Luke chapter 11, I have an opening discussion, and it's about prayer. One day, Jesus was praying in a certain place. When he finished, one of his disciples said to him, "Lord, teach us to pray, just as John taught his disciples." That makes no sense. These men are Jews. They have been praying all their life. Likely praying in Hebrew, because that gave God more respect. Likely using liturgical prayers, because many people felt that you really should not create your own prayers spontaneously. But they intuit something inside of Jesus' own prayer life that they want to claim. There's something different about him, and they want him to explain it. He likely prays in Aramaic, very popular, and he does it spontaneously. So Jesus said, "Well, when you pray, pray this, Father, hallowed be your name, your kingdom come." This is Luke's sort of shortened version of the Lord's Prayer. "Give us each day our daily bread. Forgive us our sins, for we also forgive everyone who sins against us, and lead us not into temptation." The irony of all of this is that Jesus is saying, yeah, when you pray, do it like this. And then we took that prayer and turned it into a strict liturgy. It's really fascinating how it goes. Probably Jesus would say, that wasn't what I had in mind, but there we are. All right, so then the conversation isn't finished. What happens next is all about prayer. And as a good Middle Easterner, Jesus is going to drive home his point with a story. That's what he has to do. So therefore, he says, "Can any one of you imagine having a friend and going to him at midnight?" Now, we will learn here what isn't going to happen. This will never happen. Now, can you imagine a friend going to him at midnight and saying to him, "Friend, lend me 3 loaves of bread, for a friend of mine has arrived on a journey and I have nothing to set before him. Will he answer from within, 'Don't bother me. The door is now closed. My children are in bed with me. I cannot get up and give you anything.'" Is that going to happen? There isn't a chance that's going to happen. Unbelievable. I mean, can you imagine this? A guy refusing this? In the Middle East, the poor share resources. The key in this entire thing is that in a village community, no one owns their own oven. Ovens are communal property, and you only bake once every maybe 3 days. You have stale bread. What the man is saying is that someone arrived, took me by surprise. I have no fresh bread, but I know who bakes today. And so therefore, I am going to my neighbor, we'll call him the sleeper, he's in bed, and I go to my neighbor, I'll call through the window, "Ibrahim, Ibrahim, I have a guest, you have fresh bread, please will you give me what I need?" One of the things that is most foreign to us, I think, is how expected it is that when you have a need, your neighbor should give. That is a big thread in this culture. Let me illustrate it for you this way. My wife and I have supported children with World Vision International for a long time, you know, $40 a month, that kind of thing. And since I'm in the Middle East a fair bit, I have visited some of the kids. So we've got a child in Cairo. And so I was in Cairo, and beforehand I contacted World Vision, and I filled out all the forms, and I said I'd like to visit our child. Most people don't do that. They check you out closely before you get to visit your child. They don't want funny stuff happening. So in Cairo, I was met by a World Vision local staffer. They walked me across town. I came to this incredibly poor place, big building, 6 stories tall. She said, we're going up to the top. I was probably the first American to go into this building. It was crazy. I would have never found this place. So up the building, we walked all the way to the top, got up to the top room. The family was there. There was a one bedroom and a kitchen and one bedroom, basically. And that was also a living room. We sat on the bed. The little girl came out, cute yellow dress. I remember that. And the father and the mother were there. It was just a really sweet moment. They coached me on what to give. I had a cute backpack, some pencils as a gift for the girl. Anyway, it was a great moment. And then the father arrived from a back room carrying a case of Coca-Cola. I'm talking a wood case with glass bottles. What? He's walking and he walks right up to me and he says, "Have a Coke." In English, it was awesome. Well, a secret about me, I hate Coke. I hate Pepsi. So anyway, I said to the World Vision person who spoke Arabic, and I don't, and I said, I don't like Coke. And she goes, "You're drinking four of these, dudes." So little bottles here, little ones. That was cool. It was, they're originals, man. So I put down through it. It was really, there it was, right? So Cokes all the way around. Anyway, we had a great visit. We walked down from the building. We walked out. And my World Vision host said, "Stop. Turn around and look at the building." And there for 6 floors were the families of the entire building looking out. And my host said to me, "The entire building put together cash to buy that one tray of Coca-Cola because it was the real thing. And they're poor. And the case is worth 1 week's wage for the man that gave it to you." It was like, really? That's incredible. Also, this idea that communities come together to do this. It's because you are preserving honor. That's what you're doing. The whole building is saying we're going to honor the person who has come and visited. I have been in more situations in the Middle East where I have been given food and gifts. My house is full of gifts of people who are wanting to honor me. So if somebody comes to your house and says, "Can I have bread?" Are you going to say, "Don't bother me"? Are you kidding? The next morning you will be shamed for your disrespect. So Jesus says, "I'll tell you what will happen. Though he will not give him anything," who is he right there? The sleeper, right? "He will not give him anything, having arisen," this is the sleeper, "because of friendship." Oh, yes. So the sleeper, Ibrahim, does not lay in his bed and say, "Oh, that's my good friend out the window. I like him. I'm going to give him bread because we're friends." No, it's not about friendship, but because of his what? An idea. He will get up and give him whatever he wants. Now I look at this and I think, ooh, what is this? The slap in the face has got to be in the center of the second stanza. What is this? An idea. Now, do you know that most of your Bibles translate that right there as persistence? And the "his" refers to the guy at the window making the request. That is an enormous interpretive decision, and we don't actually have any justification for that. So the first thing I have to figure out is, what does "his" refer to? And then I have to figure out, what does "an idea" mean? If you decide that this whole stanza is describing the guy in bed, it's about him. It's not about the asker. It's about the guy in bed. And he has this "an idea" as a part of who he is. So I've got to do some homework. I've got to make sure I understand what "an idea" means. Is this a virtue? Is this a bad thing or a good thing? And in the history of this word, it is like saying it is, the word "eidos" means shame in Greek. In Greek, if you want to negate something, you put alpha in front of it. Aneidos. It's like unshame. Aneidos means shameless. So if I say to you, you are so shameless in the way you went after that. You see how persistence came into this? But in the Middle East, shame is the thing you want to avoid in all of your life. It's a shame on our culture. So therefore, I want to be known as a person who has no shame. I want to be known as somebody who is aneidos. Ah, that means shame is not on me. The man in bed is saying, I am a man of honor. My children are asleep right next to me. This is the moment where I wake them up and tell them, get out of bed. You will see now Middle Eastern hospitality. So, therefore, if aidos means shame, that's a negative quality in the Middle East. So therefore, aneidos means a virtue. It is something that I want. So therefore, Balin, Yeremias, and many interpreters say, we have got here a story which is actually spoken in Aramaic, and it presumes the honor of the guy in bed. The meaning here then is, when you pray, pray with confidence because the one who hears your prayer has honor. He is not someone who is going to shame himself. Though he will not give him anything, having arisen because of friendship, but because of the sleeper's absence of shame or his honor, he will get up and give him whatever he wants. Oh, this is enormous. This is really enormous. So the parable is about the nature of God, not the performance of the one who prays. And tell me, is that the gospel? You bet that's the gospel. Prayer is successful. The bread gets delivered because of the character of the one who hears you, not because of your ability to perform. Now, if you're unsure, simply go to what follows, and no one who reads the parable listens to Jesus keep talking. Ask, seek, and knock. For everyone who asks will receive, seeks, and finds. It will be open to you. What father among you? Now, watch this closely. If his son asks for a fish, would be given a serpent. What? The Sea of Galilee, which is Jesus' home culture, has swimming on the bottom, a kind of catfish, I think it is. The Arabs called it a barbut. It is black. It is long. It's about this long. It has no scales. It's really ugly. It's why I tell my students, oh, swim way out in the Sea of Galilee and put your feet on the bottom. Anyway, it is unclean fish. You cannot eat them. So it isn't a snake. It isn't a serpent. It's not an eel. It's like an eel. If your son says, can I have a fish that is kosher, Dad? Would you give your son a barbut? No, of course not. Why? Because you are a father who has what? Honor. If your son asks for an egg, will you give him a scorpion? There are scorpions all over the Middle East, many varieties. There's a white scorpion, which is really kind of amazing. It has a hard shell. It cuts. It puts its tail underneath its body. It sits on rocks. I've seen people sit on them thinking it was a rock. The tail flips out, and you're in serious trouble. If you take an egg and slice it in half like so and set it down, it'll look exactly like a white scorpion. But you were never going to give your son a scorpion when he asks for an egg, because you are a father with. Matthew has another one right here. He says, if your son came and said, could I have some bread? Would you give him a stone? The limestone just east of Jerusalem weathers nicely. And if you've been out there, you'll know there's stone all over the desert, the wilderness. It looks just like pita bread. They just need to open a Mexican restaurant out there. If you then who are evil know how to give good gifts to your children, if you know what it means to be a father of honor, then don't you believe God is like that as well? You see what's happening here? Jesus is explaining confidence in prayer based on the character of God. And he wants to free us from anxiety-driven prayer that seems to be based on our own performance. Now, when I do this, and we have to end, I think I realize we're over time, so we should probably quit here and just call it a day. Every time I do this, this is the parable that is given to me immediately. Do you know this parable? Yeah. And it's not difficult to do. If you're collecting books, Bailey has a great treatment of this one. But it's a woman. She has to be persistent. It's about prayer. Again, it's another parable. There's only two parables about prayer. This is the one about prayer. It's in Luke 18. This woman is persistent. She has to fight her way all the way up to a corrupt judge who, it says, feels no shame. It's the worst thing you can say about somebody in this culture. And so the guy, the judge, says, "Well, I better take care of this woman because she is going to wear me out." Actually, it says here, "She is going to strike me in the face." That's what it actually says in Greek. It's really kind of cool. Anyway, so therefore, he says, "I don't fear God. I don't respect other people. I'm a man who has shame written all over me, but I don't care." Then Jesus says, "Look at what the unrighteous judge says." In other words, you had better be persistent if the one to whom you appeal is corrupt. If the one to whom you are addressing your prayers is rotten to the core. Yeah, you'd better be persistent. You better beat down the door of heaven. But if you are standing before a righteous judge, you have nothing to worry about. Good news? Does that sync with what we just did in Luke 11? Amen? Yeah, exactly. So therefore, when we work with the parables of Jesus, there are surprises embedded in the parables. And I think they are a gold mine of surprises. But we need to use the right tools. We do. All right. Thanks for your patience.